What's up, OUXers? Today I've got a conversation for you with the one, the only, Lou Rosenfeld. You've probably read the book he helped write, the Polar Bear book, which put information architecture on the map. If you haven't, we'll put a link in the show notes. You may have been to one of his conferences, and I can bet you've read one of the very high-quality books that come out of his publishing house, Rosenfeld Media. Those are very nice books. I have, like, I don't know, 15 of them or something. So in this conversation, Lou and I jump around to so many interesting topics. Library science, the metaverse, sustainable IA, the double-edged sword of metaphor, and one of our favorite subjects on the OUX pod, naming things. But before we jump into it, a few timely announcements for you. So if you're listening to this in late 2022 or 2024 or something, you can just probably skip along to the conversation. Okay, so first, next Thursday, that's February 3rd, 2022, we are having our first OUX happy hour of the year. Marcia Haverty, a repeat speaker at the IA Summit and an IA lead at Autodesk, will be talking about OUX from her expert information architecture lens. So her and her team at Autodesk are doing something pretty cool. They're going through the self-paced OUX masterclass as an internal cohort and applying OUX to all the complexity that they're facing there. So go to meetup.com/objectorientedUX to RSVP. Again, that is next Thursday. That's going to be 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, February 3rd, 2022. By the way, if you're interested in creating an internal cohort at your organization, basically if you have more than three people that have been wanting to do this, been wanting to go through the Object-Oriented UX Masterclass, please contact me. Contact me at hello@rewiredux.com. We'll have that email address also in the show notes. So if you have more than three people, we've had anywhere from three to up to 15 people doing a cohort together internally, everybody going through the OUX masterclass, you're going to get some great discounts. You're going to get some economy of scale as well as some free office hours with me for your group. So the more people you have sign up, the more office hours you get. I also give you some good guidance on how to run an internal cohort and basically DIY it with all of the material inside your own organization. So again, contact me if you're interested in that and we'll work something out. That's hello@rewiredux.com. Okay. Next, second, cohort six is getting close to filling up. So this is cohort. This is the for the OUX certification program. This cohort kicks off on February 21st, 2022. We've still got a couple spots left. So if you're ready to dive in head first and get certified through this whirlwind of a professional development experience, now is the time. Here are two recent reviews of this 10-week course. So Mariella B., she says, "The ORCA process that is taught throughout this program brings the much-needed structure required to untangle any kind of complexity. It really can be applied to anything. Sophia is a very generous teacher. And make sure you have no doubt about the concepts or exercises. The course material is very well designed, easy to follow, and very practical. I could start applying recently learned concepts to my work as soon as day one." That is awesome. Thank you so much, Mariella. So Allie F., she says, "So, you've been assigned wireframes for a new feature. Are you staring at a blank screen or some questionable user stories? Is complexity creeping in from the corners? Take a deep breath and step back. Include OUX in your process and immediately effective, but also future-proofish screens design themselves. Well, they do after you and your team have examined each object in the system to clarify its purpose and relationships. Whether you have 2 hours or 2 months, OUX can scale up or down to serve the scope. Having asked all the right questions, you'll build confidence that you're designing a system that works, for those building it and for those using it." I absolutely love that. That's so awesome. I feel the exact same way. Allie, thank you so much. So head over to oux.com/certification to grab one of those last spots. And if you need more convincing, go to oux.com/testimonials and just scroll and scroll and scroll through all of those testimonials. Okay, one last announcement. I've got a new case study coming out on Monday. I don't know what day that is. That's maybe February 1st? Yeah, whatever day that is. So that case study is about me applying object-oriented UX to Georgia Tech Research Institute's website. So if you want to make sure to get all those alerts on new stuff coming out, new articles coming out like this case study, we've got an ebook coming out soon, a total handbook of the Orca process. The first folks that are going to know about that are those in the newsletter. So go to oeux.com/newsletter to make sure you get that GTRI case study that's coming up in your inbox on Monday, and all the other good stuff that is in that newsletter. Okay, let's go talk to Lou. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Lou Rosenfeld, welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast.
Thanks, Sophia. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm honored to have you. I'm absolutely honored. We have a lot of fun stuff to talk about today, but I want to start out with just a little bit of your background. So you started off with, I think, your undergrad in history, and then you moved into library science. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm just curious, like, What originally drew you to history, and how did that transition into library science?
You know, that's an interesting question. I never really thought about it, to be honest. I just enjoy history. I just started reading one of the many books on World War I that seemed to be out there just a couple days ago. It's just like a hobby. And you know, when I was 18, I had really no idea what I wanted. So that seemed good enough. And then when I was about a month before graduation with that history degree, I realized I needed to get a job. I hadn't really given that any thought. And worked around 7 or 8 jobs over 1.5 years after graduation. Tried about everything. I figured at least through the process of elimination, I might learn what I was interested in. And along the way, I decided I had a little bit of an entrepreneurial streak, and I wanted to create a business that was essentially a rental apartment listings service. This was like in the late 80s, and databases were starting to become more accessible to work with. And I lived in a college town where it was really hard to find housing, which I was doing every year. So I decided that would be a business that maybe I could actually do, but I wanted to learn something about databases and computers, and I didn't want to get a CS degree because I kind of knew I wasn't going to be good at it. And I didn't want to get a business degree because I didn't want to study things like accounting, you know, which would be required. And so I figured I'd go to library school. We had a library school in Michigan. I was living in Ann Arbor, and it was a quick degree in maybe 1.5 years. And I figured, well, you know, databases of books couldn't be all that different than databases of apartments, which was, I learned pretty quickly, was a pretty naive assumption. But it got me into the program, and I learned quite a bit about databases. So it worked out.
So when I was thinking about that connection between history and library science, I was like, wow, that's like such a leap. But then I was thinking about it more, and I was thinking, well, I think the original libraries were mostly history books, right? It's like history and philosophy. Those were the original libraries. It was kind of like, how do we organize our history? Do you know, was that like the original purpose of a library?
I'm trying to think, you know, like what we learned about the great library of Alexandria.
Yeah.
And if it was really there as a repository of history, I'm not sure. But, you know, you might see the angle of archives, right? I mean, if you are an archivist, you're often working with an historical archive, and archive studies are often inside a library studies program. Well, I'm not sure there are that many library studies programs anymore. They're all now been rebranded as iSchools, but that's a whole nother story.
Oh, and on the note of stories, I mean, I also think of like the difference between something like history and something like library science is history is this kind of like linear story, right? It's just a story of time. So it's very linear of like this happened before this and this is what caused this. And I'm sure there's lots of like branching and cause effect things that you learn when you're going deep into history, but it is by and large linear versus something like library science and information architecture is these kind of webs of information that we're creating, it's linked information that we're creating.
Well, wait a minute. I'll question that because
Okay,
I see why
please.
you'd say that about history, but don't we live in the multiverse and everything is sort of connected in weird ways across time and space? And I mean, like, you know, what I find really interesting about history is that yes, you have a linear story, but that often serves as a backdrop for themes and ideas. And changes that occur again and again at different points in time and in different places. So
And that's so
that's
true. And even different versions of history, right?
right,
So we've
right.
gotten one version of history, and now we're kind of going back and saying, okay, where was that version of history a little bit biased? Maybe there's like another version of history. And then we can kind of, and I mean, on the multiverse, I don't know if quantum physicists have confirmed the multiverse. It's a really hard thing to wrap my head around. But yeah, I mean, there are even multiple realities based on perspective. And different ways you can string things together. Like there's a book, maybe you've read it, called The World in Six Glasses. Have you heard of this?
No, I don't know about that.
So it's a history based on six different types of drinks. So coffee, tea, beer, wine, spirits, and water. And it's a core sample of history. Based it told six times over. It's like a history of our world
Wow.
told through the lens of these different types of these different drinks. And it's so interesting how you can kind of take this core sample of history through a single lens and learn so much and see it's you know like history and human beings and really anything that you want to start learning about. It's very fractal in nature, right? Like the more you learn about it, the more there is to learn about it. And history is kind of like that. You can take anything. You can take Michael Pollan has a similar book, The Botany of Desire, and he does it through four different plants. He does it through apples, tulips, potatoes, and marijuana. And basically takes like a look at history and culture through those. So, yeah, maybe it's not
Well, I
so
know what I'll be
linear.
reading. I already had pollen on my list, but I'm going to definitely look at the six what is it? Six
So the history,
glasses.
the six glasses I don't know, I don't remember the author, but yeah, it was very good, very interesting. And yeah, The Botany of Desire, highly recommend that. I think it's my favorite Michael Pollan book. I believe I've read all of his books, and that's by far my favorite and one of the easiest to read, actually. So I want to understand a little bit about what makes you particularly good at what you do. You do a lot of you in your career, you did a lot of organizing of information, which led you into organizing content in the form of a publishing house, and now you're organizing conferences, and really you're organizing information. What is it about Lou Rosenfeld that makes you gravitate to that makes you good at that? What kind of
Now, I don't know
qualities?
that I would say I'm necessarily good at
I'm
it,
pretty
but
sure
I
you are.
definitely, you know, in the sense that someone's got to do some of this stuff, so I get stuck with it. But, well, all right, you know, joking aside, I guess, our psychologies, as well as our aptitudes, are so important in answering questions like these. And so, you know, I have decent information organization skills, but I think being the youngest of five boys, that birth position and combined with being something of a peacemaker, which often youngest children are, and wanting people to be happy and wanting to be liked, it's a personality type and it can manifest itself in interesting ways. And so I, long story short, I'm good at convening people and I'm good at convening information and actually putting them together and seeing where there's a gap of that could be filled with some combination of people and information, and then getting out of the way. And there's a movie that I wonder if you've seen, Sophia, that I just love this movie, and I saw it many years ago. I think it's been out for over 20 years, and only recently realized why I love it so much. And it's The Commitments. Have you ever seen The Commitments?
No.
In a nutshell, The Commitments is a story of a young guy in Dublin who makes it his mission to create and manage the greatest R&B band that Dublin has ever seen.
Okay.
And he goes around and he starts finding musicians, and he finds a horn section here and a guitarist there and some backup singers there and so on. And he finds them and he puts them together, and they don't generally like each other, and it's really hard, and they get screwed over by the concert promoters, and it's just like he's just barely holding it together, and he's not even a musician himself. But
Right.
just for a moment, they make the most beautiful, amazing music before they completely implode. And he's okay with that. He got to do what he wanted to do. And I like that idea. I like getting people together and getting out of their way and giving them enough infrastructure that they can make that music. The real challenge that the hero of The Commitments wasn't able to do was to make that sustainable, to get out of the way and make it so those people could continue making beautiful music with the infrastructure they needed to support them. And actually, I tried to convene people and content for years through the IA community. I helped start the Information Architecture Summit, which eventually became the Information Architecture Conference. I started co-started the IA Institute. I tried to get the User Experience Network going, spent about 8 years on that. A lot of volunteer efforts, some of which were fruitful and some of which weren't. And what I learned was that you have to have some kind of sustainable model that backs up these efforts to convene. And especially if the convening is being done by volunteers who aren't going to be able to sustain their own efforts. And so that's kind of why I started Roosevelt Media, was to have a company that would be a business that would figure out a way to monetize the continued life of these conventions of sorts. And that's what I've been doing. That I start a lot of things, but I have a team that keeps them going.
Well, that's, I've never really thought of it this way. And thinking about what I do with clients is it's a lot of creating structures so that they can put their own content in, right? So
Yeah.
that they can I'm not creating the content, or that users can, right? So if you're doing making a product that has a lot of user-generated content, it's about how do we facilitate these different roles, these different types of people, because it's always going to be multiple roles usually and multiple different personas creating their different types of content. And we need to create receptacles. We need to create really great information containers for these that actually then connect to other content in a way to kind of make sense of it and make sure that it's findable, that make sure that other people can find content that is being created. And then you take it, and if I look at
you know, you're, if I zoom out and think like, okay, Lou Rosenfeld starting is like creating these information containers and figuring out the best way to do that, to create structures of information, and then moving into publishing, a lot of people would be like, wait, what? But it makes so much sense because it's, you know, publishing, you're creating structures for people to create content, whether those are books or eBooks or talks at conferences, you're structuring it for other people to create the good stuff.
Yeah. And I that's what I've been doing for a long time. But I think what's really important is to create those containers in a way that they have a chance of living long beyond certainly my personal involvement.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just seen too many things die in the vine.
Yeah.
And that's a painful thing. So I think, you know, maybe baking in sustainable models into our information architectures is something that we don't always think about. And part of the problem has been that many of us do IA, or at least I did, at least as a consultant, or before I was an independent consultant, when I had Argus Associates with Peter Morville, and we did it, you know, for clients. It's really hard to create something that's sustainable when you know you're not really being paid to do that, nor will you be around once the thing's up and running.
Right. And what's the secret? how do we create these structures and make them sustainable so that when we walk away from them, they keep serving the client for years, 10 years to come? They create even foundations so that when we do get called back in 2 years, let's not refactor everything. Let's just, we want to add these things to it. And we created this really elegant foundation. We can build upon it without undoing stuff.
Well, okay. So I think, you know, you've been doing a lot of really good work in this particular challenge in that I think you need, first of all, to make an IA sustainable, you need to frame it in language that makes sense for the organization. So, you know, we can talk about moment prisons later if you want, but I've always been pretty impartial. Well, for a long time, I've not cared whether you call something IA or something like it. As long as people get it and can grasp it. So how you present it, how you brand it, how you communicate it, what language you use, I think you go with what works for a given setting rather than what, you know, Lou and Peter and Jorge say in their book, what they call things. That's really immaterial. That's, you know, for you, but not for your clients or not for your organization necessarily. I think there's also another factor in sustainable IA, which is finding opportunities to make it as flexible as possible. And by definition, to me, that means taking something of an object-oriented approach.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of devils in the details of how you move from unstructured or semi-structured content to something that looks like a relational database. You know that as much as, if not more than anybody. But that is why I think your work is really important, because if you are creating an information architecture that is inflexible, it'll be the man. It'll be the establishment mm-hmm. that, you know, we want to create, desire paths that get around. And ultimately, it's like, just like we have shadow IT, you're going to have shadow IA, and people are going to disregard it. And you don't want to create the man. You want to create, you know, something that people can actually work with so that it just becomes second nature. And that's actually not just flexibility, it's learnability, which, again, to some degree goes back to how you frame it.
And I would even go further and to say it shouldn't even be second nature. It should be first nature to use the system.
Because
if like, for example, for conferences, so if you're a conference organizer and I created a system for you, you should go into that system and you should see the things that just exist in your conference. You should see speakers, you should see sessions, you should see days, and then they should be connected the way that they connect at your conference, right? Even recordings, like how do recordings relate to sessions? How do, you know, breakout sessions and workshops relate to sessions? And all those things should just, it shouldn't be so much about, let me go design this information architecture. So Ren Pope and I talked about this a little bit, but I want to do some information archaeology. I think that's Ren's term, with how does, you know, how does a Rosenfeld conference work in reality? Like, what is it, just how do the things work together? And then I can create a system that reflects that. So like in such like a one-to-one way, and I'm not talking about display or skeuomorphism or anything like that. It's that, or even metaphor, really. It's just, here's your things and here they are on the screen, and they, you know, you create a new session. All right, well, does the session have one speaker, or can a session have multiple speakers? Like, and it should just work the way, and it shouldn't, oh, I can only select one speaker because it wasn't set up to accommodate multiple speakers or sessions or called something else.
Well, we're solving all that simply because we're using WordPress 5. I got you there. I got you there. It helps. Oh, it does help. But yes, I just really wanted to tweak you there.
Oh, me, why so aren't you using, why not use Webflow, just out of curiosity? Was Webflow not robust enough?
You know, I'm not the expert, and I didn't make all those decisions, but I will say that, you know, we have been pretty invested in WordPress for many years. I don't know about the migration from from WordPress 4 to 5 versus WordPress 4 to Webflow. But at this point, it's moot, and you know, our agency is doing their best.
Right. It's changing from one system to another. Right. I mean, my life is so heavily invested in Trello, and I know that Notion is a better tool, and I know that Notion is like beautifully object oriented and everything that I want in a tool, really. But like the idea of moving, it's just, I don't know if it'll ever happen.
That's that is the sustainable business model for so many applications, right? It's like, it doesn't really matter if we make it learnable and flexible, as long as you're locked in. And you know, you have all these sunk costs. That's their model of sustainability.
So I definitely want to talk about moment presence, but we were getting to like, you know, flexibility and like, how do you make a system that is like well-defined yet still flexible? And I think that moment presence we're going to go straight into that. That's a nice segue, but we were kind of dancing around this, and I want to address it with you, because I, like, basically every information architect that I talk to, we get in on this, but how do you feel about iterative IA? Like, if I'm iterating on the information architecture, Any thoughts on that, on iterating on information architecture?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you do IA that does not involve some form of iteration. I don't think it's any kind of designed environment or system that can work without iteration. I mean, as good a job as you can do up front, you know, the world is a universe of variables that are constantly changing. And I used to give a talk all the time called Redesign Must Die, because I just felt like, well, yeah, you know, this sort of thought about getting things right, and then you walk away from it, you know, even you could get it right, it just won't stay that way. And you know, we always used to preach the three circle Venn diagram in IA world of content, context, and users. And if you scratch the surface of any of those three, there's like dozens of variables within each that are all changing. So you have moving targets built on top of smaller moving targets. And, you know, they say it's turtles all the way down. No, it's moving targets all the way down. So things have to iterate. And, you know, we were talking about sustainability through learnability and flexibility a moment ago. And that's really like, you know, tantamount to sustainability. Is like, if you are not flexible, if your information architecture is not flexible and learnable, then it ain't going to iterate and it ain't going to keep up.
Right. I agree with all that. I'm going to, part two of this question is, what's more iterative, information architecture or UI?
Well, you know, as you're bringing this up, I've got a picture of Stuart Brand's pace layers diagram floating in just a few inches of in front of my face.
Wonderful.
You know, it's like a organic augmented reality for me, but
burned into your brain.
Exactly. I mean, it's like very few presentations I give that it doesn't come up.
There's very few podcasts that I record that doesn't come up.
I'm sure. So, you know, I mean, I won't pretend to be an expert enough in UI. I can just tell you that in IA, there are aspects that are going to be a lot more stable and other aspects that are going to be a lot more dynamic. It doesn't mean that the stable mm-hmm. stuff can't iterate, but I do think it may iterate more slowly, and that's fine. It's not an either or situation. It's just like, there's just different rates or cadences of iteration and change.
And I
think it's like, I don't know. I'm sorry. I just feel like there's like a simple-minded view of, you know, change and passage of time. Maybe this is the moment prison stuff mm-hmm. to some degree, but like we sort of think either can change or can't change, or we think you know, things have to happen at the same rate. And I don't understand that. I mean, there's very little example of anything in our lived lives that works that way.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, like, for when I think about how to make a sustainable system, a sustainable information architecture, I feel like one of the best ways to do that is to go, if I can make my information architecture rooted in a deeper pace layer. So mm-hmm. if it's rooted in reality of a business domain, like, for example, this became really clear to me when I worked on CNN election results in 2012, and then I came back in 2016 to do it again. And when I came back in 2016 as a consultant, I had this moment of like, oh my gosh, the information architecture hasn't changed. Like, we still have the Electoral College. We still have candidates. Like, and actually the information architecture of elections hasn't changed in maybe a couple hundred years. In the same way that, like, when I was working with some marketing software, and we were working on terminology, and they had this term called the augmented line item, and I was trying to figure out what it is. It turns out an augmented line item is just a campaign. And the term campaign in marketing has been around since what, the 60s or something like that. The mm-hmm. concept of a campaign has been around for a really long time. So if we can go deeper into what are those foundational things that just exist. I worked a lot in ed tech and in education, and the ways that students and classes and lessons and assignments and teachers relate to each other and what they are, what they mean, really, like, hasn't changed a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I guess the question would be, is it the objects that are fairly stable, or is it something else? I mean, what's the core, the anchor for those object-oriented systems that you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I mean, I actually often call the objects the anchors of understanding. Like, mm-hmm. like when things get really complicated, like, just hold on, hold on to those anchors of understanding. And when the winds get strong, and their relationships, I mean, the relationships do change when you move them from context to context. And sometimes we can build new relationships with technology, relationships where before you couldn't see that relationship in the real world. You couldn't see it when you were paper-based, but now that we're, you know, we can bring in dynamic content, and we can build relationships, and we can, you know, match things up based on metadata, we can build new relationships. But, and this definitely starts getting, and we've been talking about these moment prisons, and probably a lot of people don't, maybe have not had the pleasure of reading your article, but let's just go ahead and let me summarize a little bit of moment prisons, and then kind of hand it off to you, so we can at least give give our listeners some context what we're talking about here. And maybe this can help answer that question on what is, like, how can we, with information architecture, create a sustainable system that's also flexible? And maybe part of that is like drilling down into the pace layer to find those things that change the slowest. Because if we can kind of use that foundation, then maybe we'll iterate, but we're going to iterate in ways that's not so expensive. Because iterating on information architecture, especially if you have an object that has 7,000 instances or something like that, or 7 million instances, iterating on that information architecture can be really expensive. Like adding a new piece of metadata, you know, 6 months after all this content has been added and you have to go manually add a new piece of metadata, that can be tough.
Although it's always cool when that can be automated, right? When you can build those links through combining existing metadata or through coding searches, fairly decent, consistent searches between objects in a particular instance. But that's really another story, right? I mean, that's like getting deep into the weeds of your work.
Well, and so, for example, and maybe you have some thoughts on this, but just for some example on making that sustainable system. So an example that I've used before is for like a pet finder app. So let's say you have a pet or an animal as an object in the system with a bunch of different instances, and you're trying to find the right pet. And if you look at petfinder.com and you look at a bunch of descriptions of the pets, you'll see these patterns of almost every description talks about energy level for the pet, usually dogs, and and whether the animal is good with kids or not. And it's completely unstructured and non-structured. You can't search it, right? Because it's all just locked up in a, as Karen McGrain would say, a terrible blob of content. Like, it's not structured. Going back, like if that had been introduced early on, and you know, and they have thousands and thousands and thousands of instances of these pets, I think it's a national company. That's going to be really tough, right? You're going to have to kind of retrofit that, or bring in some natural language processing, right? Like that would be to be able to extract that information and put it into structured data,
which is a good thing to do. But if the you can't natural language your way to you know, if there's crap that you're, if you're putting natural language processes at crap in the first place, you can't natural language your way to quality. I just, you know, it's going to help. It's better than nothing usually. But anyway, again, another interesting rabbit hole we could go down.
Yeah. And it feels like, okay, well, we could have just structured this a little bit better if we had thought a little bit more in the front end about how we structure an animal and like, what do users need when they're trying to find an animal? Oh, it turns out that like energy level and whether the animal's good with kids or not is super important. We could have taken that research and baked that into the information architecture, into the content management system. So when somebody at the Humane Society is entering an animal in, they just have that as a field. And so like doing that, like retroactive changing of information architecture. And that's what I was talking about, like, is information architecture iterative? Like, yes, it's iterative, but we shouldn't rely on that, because this is where we draw the distinction of iteration and rework. Like, are we iterating on this because we're building on a strong foundation, or are we just reworking and refactoring stuff because we didn't fully think it through and we didn't give time and space to think it through?
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. I mean, there's just stuff that you need to invest in. You need to do the design work to get a pretty good foundation in place, and so that the iteration you do is geared toward improvement rather than fixing, repairing.
Right, exactly. So, okay, so your article on moment prisons and how we can avoid them. So basically what you're talking about here is labels and clear definitions and encapsulation. Even encapsulation of some sort of like abstract concepts can be good, can be helpful. And moments, I think it was really interesting how you sort of think of moments helps us deal with the complexity of space-time. Like, we're not really good. Maybe we're pretty good at space, but time, ooh, we're sometimes not very terrible at time. And so moments helps us kind of like objectify little chunks of time in our mm-hmm. head and like helps us keep it straight. So we have these like little discrete blocks that we can use. And like with the help of the Polar Bear book gets a lot of credit for this. A lot of people found this label of information architect and mm-hmm. they were like, yes, this is what I do. This is so helpful. This is so validating. But what is the other side of this? What is the double-edged sword of this that you talk about in your article?
So we find something that works for us, and it partly works for us because, as you said, it helps validate us. Oh, this is what I've been doing all along. But it's not only that, it's validating us in the eyes of others. So it's not just that, oh, I'm an information architect, but there's others like me and we share something in common. And, you know, we can get from the point of like achieving identity to actual communion. And that's powerful, especially mm-hmm. in an area that's fairly new or misunderstood or you know, where we're so individually, personally, so unsure of ourselves. Okay, but then it very quickly, it becomes a millstone. So it's, you know, I'm the veteran of this whole time in the IA world as it was growing and maturing, where, you know, we spent so much energy on the perfect definition and, you know, but wait a minute, this definition leaves me out. I'm really working more at the interface level or, you know, whatever it might be. No, I'm really, you know, I'm kind of really more a content person. And so like, you know, finally there were like everything kind of fractured and you got people that said, well, actually, I think that the thing that I am is an interaction designer or a content strategist or whatever. And so much of our identities were wrapped up in it that people were really like, you know, fighting and disagreeing like in ways that were like almost personal and really a lot of relationships were fractured. And you know, it just becomes this terrible label of like that in, at least in IA's case, but certainly a lot of other newish fields where, you know, people invest way too much of their identity, their whole self-worth and being in a label mm-hmm. that really only has a very limited lifespan to begin with. And it's not something necessarily that does anyone any good to prop up beyond its expiration date. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that we should have just thrown out the concept of information architecture, but we got so stuck on it that we kind of forgot that there were other people out there that, you know, could benefit from what we were doing, but weren't going to and didn't see it as something called information architecture, for whom that term wasn't useful. And so when I used to do work with clients as an information architecture consultant, as a very well known one, I would never use IA when I was talking to them, unless they used it, unless they seemed to understand it, because it just became a something that got in the way of diagnosing the actual problems that needed to be addressed. So one of the examples of that I give in the article is portals.
Yes.
And I know that unless you're 50 years older or more like I am, you probably don't even recognize that term and why it was so important.
Oh, I had to design a portal. I did.
You're a youngster. All right.
So I'm a youngster-ish. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, early on. What does that mean? And, you know, and I can't tell you how often I would have clients that would say to me, we like to bring you in because we need a portal. And it's like, wait a minute. First of all, I'm the one who's supposed to tell you what you need if you're bringing me in. You know, that's why where my expertise comes in. But what the hell is a portal? We need some kind of aggregation of information that works better than what we have now. Well, that's fine. But if you call it a portal, you basically leapfrog over the diagnostics phase to something that, you know, is only going to be clearly defined by the marketing teams of portal vendors. So, you know, you've just basically opened yourself up for making a very high-end purchase of a tool, typically, that doesn't really solve the problem because you don't even really know what the problem is. So I used to ban people from using the word portal if they asked me to design a portal from them. Because, you know, I'd say, like, you can't use that word because it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't tell me anything about your problem. It doesn't tell you anything about your problem.
Right. I think I have to, like, so I do remember the my first in IA summit that I went to, where I did a workshop on object-oriented UX back in 2015. And I remember going to that IA summit and realizing that there's factions, realizing that, like, oh, there's UX and IA, and the IA is, like, you know, something different, it seemed. And I think nobody was, like, mean to me or anything, but I did feel that, like, okay, there's something I didn't realize about this industry. So I hear what you're saying about, you know, I can imagine you being there kind of from the beginning, like, seeing actually relationships crumble because of, like, these strongly held definitions on what.
And listen, I'm as guilty as anyone. I got dirt on my hands just like anybody else from those days. So I just want to be clear about that. I don't pretend to be pure in any aspect of this history. I look back on it with some embarrassment and sadness.
And, well, and currently, I mean, the elephant here in the digital room is object-oriented UX, you know, creating a label for something, right? And tying myself to it. And I remember in the beginning having conversations, some at the IA summit, like, oh, this really sounds like OOIA, like you should call it OOIA instead of OOUX. And I just want to, like, make sure it's clear to you, Lou, and everybody listening, like, the goal, and this is actually in the manifesto, is that OOUX goes away. Like, we want it to melt away. Because, like, right now it's a useful thing to say, because this is a different way of thinking about user experience. It is kind of turning the process inside out in many ways. You know, thinking about the structure before thinking about the screens, and thinking about the objects before thinking about the verbs, nouns before verbs kind of thinking. And so it's useful right now, but the goal is that this becomes mainstream, and this is just the way that user experience is done. So we don't really need to call it anything different. But right now, yeah, it's a useful term to differentiate and to hold on to. And I'm curious about, like, where is this? How do we know when we've painted ourselves into a corner and over-defined something versus having something that's a useful term? Like, portal to me, I mean, I love the Japanese language, not that I know Japanese, but they have these great words to encapsulate complex concepts, like ikigai, you know, the reason to get up in the morning. And once you encapsulate it and create, like, it's an easy thing to say, you can kind of manipulate that better. It's a better brick of understanding that you can use to, like, create new concepts with, versus something a little bit more ephemeral, like the reason to get up in the morning, or they have, like, Kaizen, you know, continuous improvement, or there's another word, I forget what it is, but it's like owing your boss something.
But at a certain point, if you use, if these labels, you know, like you said, they're like a, I don't know if you put it this way, like a building block that's useful, but then they become the building blocks of other somewhat abstract blocks and then on and on, and suddenly you, like, abstract things to death, and, you know, you lose a connection to what's going on in the trenches. And you know, so I guess to try to get to answer your question, I think one of the real signs of this becoming a problem, like a term or a label or a metaphor starting to become a prison, a moment prison, is when we get emotional about it.
Mm.
So like, you know, why am I being attacked for using this? Wait a minute, should it be personal? You shouldn't attack someone personally, nor should you feel personal about this language or this metaphor. Why is my economic well-being the reason I am, you know, aligning myself to whatever, information architecture, let's say, or OUS? Is that the reason? If that's the case, then it's probably a bit too long in the tooth. And you'll find, for whatever reason, whether it's economic or something or emotional, if we're propping something up for those kinds of reasons, that's the point at which I think we're no longer doing ourselves, the community, or even the world a service any longer.
Yeah.
We're doing it for ourselves.
I love that. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's when is it useful, and when it starts becoming emotional, is it now, is it still useful for getting emotional about it? So I know we just have a few minutes left, and I really want to, you just mentioned metaphor. I feel like we need to get to metaphor and how that can also be this double-edged sword. And I mean, I gravitate to metaphor. I love metaphor. I think it helps to, like you were talking about these layers of abstraction. I think that metaphor helps us like concretize abstract concepts so that we can understand them better. Like I always talk about financial institutions.
Concretize, that's a great metaphor.
Yeah, it is. Oh, metaphor inception. But like, okay, so finance. Finance is one of the most abstract things, worlds. And I mean, it's just, it's, this is the reason I think people get in trouble with finance, is because we have these so many layers of abstractions when we get up to higher levels of finance. Like we think about trading, you know, trading pigs for gold or something like that. And then we think about, okay, representing, I mean, even gold is a metaphor for something, right? So I would say like, maybe it's even more likely, you know, trading pigs for land. So we have bartering, and then we start abstracting with shells or gold or coinage. And then we get into things like digital savings accounts. And we just have these like, and then from there we get into portfolio, investment portfolios and futures and options. And we have four or five levels of abstraction from basically like an energy exchange, a simple energy exchange, like all these rules get added on. Mm-hmm. And I think metaphor can help with that, kind of like bring you back into something that you can visualize.
So,
for finance, like I kind of want fidelity.com to feel like a bunch of sock drawers, like not getting into any skeuomorphism or anything, but I want it to feel like, okay, I got my money over here. I got a little money over here. The money over here has these rules to it. The money over here has those rules to it. And then there's like little sock drawers inside of sock drawers, but it's just, it feels like a big blur of data to me.
Well, I think so. So you're trying to understand finance, you're trying to and hey, listen, it's important. It's like, you know, your livelihood, your savings, whatever. And it's uncomfortable to not really get it. And suddenly you come up, or someone comes up with a useful metaphor, and it's that aha moment for you.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, now I understand. It's like a sock drawer. Fantastic. Do you want that design to then be, you know, potentially forever constrained by the metaphor of the sock drawer simply because of the aha moment you had?
Yeah.
Like it may be that, okay, that helped me, and that metaphor is really useful. Some metaphors might really, you know, stick around for a long time and have longer term value. But for the most part, I think you'll see that, and I think we all do, that the metaphors can become really confining and constraining. And they just get kind of stale pretty quickly. So, I mean, like the example I use in the article is, hey, let's get the information architecture community together. And first we created an institute, that's what we called it. And that didn't quite work. What's an institute? Is it a learning organization? That didn't necessarily work. So then we didn't rename it, but we swapped the metaphor of the Institute for the metaphor of the professional association. Well, we can work like a professional association. Well, that's good. I mean, they didn't become a professional association initially, but they tried to think like one, and that was useful for a little while. And then suddenly they started making decisions that would be like, that made sense for professional associations in terms of hiring like an executive director and doing a lot of things that didn't really make sense given the nature of this community. But yeah. Well, that's what a professional association would do. So that's what we'll do. It's like, wait a minute, that wasn't the point of thinking about that metaphor, professional association. I was just trying to kind of, as you would say, concretize things enough that we could make some shared progress in our understanding of what we could be. It didn't mean we had to go be one. And that's how metaphors can trap us.
That's so, I mean, it's like this kind of, I don't know if it's a fidelity thing is the right word for it, but it's like in the beginning when you're a beginner, like a metaphor would make a whole lot of sense. Like if somebody's explaining an option to me, like it's a coupon for the future. Like, okay, like I can buy a coupon for milk at $5 and I hope that the price is going to go up so that I can cash in on milk. Like somebody used that metaphor for me to explain an option in the finance world. And that made a lot of sense to me, but I don't know if that's going to make sense and that's going to work for somebody on Wall Street, like a day trader, somebody who's like in this world as a professional. Probably that metaphor breaks down really quickly.
Right.
Because they're deeper into it. And maybe that's something that we can think about of like when we're as, I guess, and tell me if you disagree with this, but like for a tangible takeaway to all of this, like if our users are more beginners, should we use metaphor more versus our, if we have users who are seasoned professionals?
I think it's a great question. Here's how I try to answer it. We're all beginners at different points because any domain we live in or work in or be in tends to suffer from entropy over time. It just gets messier and more nebulous. And so every once in a while, we need to kind of step back and kind of sharpen our understanding of that domain. And I think at that point, things like metaphors are useful or labels are useful and great. I've just sharpened my understanding. I have the aha moment. At that point, I went from being a beginner to someone who's sort of comfortable again. And maybe it's not beginner. It's really someone who is having a hard time sense making. Mm-hmm. And I use this metaphor, the label or something like that to get to the aha moment of making sense, at which point I want to gently lay down my sense making tool because it's done what I need, got me to the aha. I understand now. And I should not ask too much of that tool. If I dug a hole in my garden with a trowel to plant a sunflower seed, I shouldn't expect to squeeze water out of that trowel later on to water the seed.
Yeah, that's a good metaphor for that.
But don't stick too closely to that metaphor, right?
Yeah, because then it'll break down. It'll break
that's
down.
Right.
Yeah, no, I love that. This way of use, like, we need to use metaphor responsibly and use it in a way to you know, get the job done, help with the understanding, but it shouldn't become this box that we're stuck in.
I like the way you put it, like use it responsibly. It's a tool that's very powerful and don't, you know, but it's not going to do everything. Don't ask it to, or it'll bite you. So thank you.
All right. So I know we're already over time. So I just want to kind of tee you up to just talk about the next conference that's coming up, the next Rosenfeld conference. So, and I can just speak from experience as doing a workshop at Enterprise Experience Conference. Bram Wessel and I did that twice, and they're just beautiful conferences. So I know that the next one that's coming up is going to be a hybrid conference, which is very exciting. So that is going to be the Advancing Research Conference, March 9th through 11th. So for the OUXers, who are listening, who are really all about kind of synthesizing research to figure out mental models and create information architecture from that, why would they be interested in coming? Like, why should they get excited about this conference?
Well, you know, hopefully they've already learned something, or actually do something in terms of user research. But, you know, we call it advancing research. And this is where we start looking at how research can make a bigger difference, both for the people we're trying to serve and also for us if we are researchers. So we look at things like the impacts of the democratization of research, which could be positive, could be negative, and what do you do about it? We also look at the other end of the spectrum, how research has become more strategic. And what does that mean? You got a seat at the table, now what? We look at how research, and this might be particularly relevant to your community, we look at how there's different kinds of research, how research has been siloed itself, and how we can start building bridges across those silos. Mm-hmm. Look at advanced methods. Like, I would love to see, you know, some sort of content modeling exercises, or maybe it's OUX exercises that would serve researchers. I know I used to have a lot of fun in my workshops teaching people methods for researching how objects should link to other objects. So, you know, it's our conferences. I'm biased, but we research the hell out of them. We spend a lot of time designing them. They are we spend months preparing speakers. And if you're interested in advancing research, I hope you'll join us either in New York or virtually.
That's very, very exciting. Yeah, I hope to be there in some capacity, maybe virtual, maybe in person. In person would be amazing. But it sounds great. It sounds like this is going to be not just your, we're not going to be learning research basics. This is going to be about moving the practice of research forward and being part of that really important discussion.
Exactly. There are plenty of great conferences where you can learn the basics. If you're ready to go beyond that, this is the place.
That's awesome. All right. Lou, thank you so much for your time. This was a fascinating conversation. And thank you for everything you do for the community, bringing us together in this so many amazing ways. So thanks so much. Cool.
It's all about convening, man. That's the thing. Anyway, thank you so much, Sophia. I'm going to sign off, and great to talk with you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!